888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Good evening, and welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program. Tonight, you'll be listening to a rebroadcast of guest Dr. David Abbott discussing with host Michael Shaw how trade policies, regionalization, and the European Union have destroyed British independence. We invite our listeners to stay tuned through our second hour for a rebroadcast of guest Robert Theobald, a British citizen, presenting further information regarding the regionalization of Great Britain under the Sustainable Development Policies of Agenda 21. If you'd like to learn more about tonight's topics or order CD copies of any Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program, please visit us online at f21sc.net. Now, back to the program.
This interview will assist us in understanding the real purpose behind CAFTA, the Free Trade of Americans agreement, and the American process of regionalization. I want to welcome Dr. Abbott to our show tonight. He is a medical doctor practicing in Portland, Oregon. He's a British citizen and a recent candidate under the United Kingdom Independent Party for the British Parliament. He has a unique view of the transatlantic process for regionalizing continents, both Europe and North America. Dr. Abbott will describe how the European Union is an immediate threat to the sovereignty of England. Wow, is this where Bush and Clinton are leading America? Well, let's get down to some facts about England and their trade policies and what it's meant for the political disintegration of the English society. Dr. Abbott, are you there?
I'm here.
Well,
I'm
here. It's good to hear your voice. I would also say that Dr. Abbott gave an address at the Freedom 21 conference in Reno last month, and boy, I tell you, you opened a lot of people's eyes to the fact that what we're experiencing here in America is just a replica of so many of the things that have already happened in England. And, you know, if the mother country goes the wrong way, that puts America in a desperate strait. And together, I think, by understanding the common globalist effects that are occurring in England and the United States, we might be able to avert this train wreck and bring both our countries and the world to follow back on a course of health and happiness. So what is it that you can begin to tell us about England's experience in the...
Well, as Dr. Yates was saying, it was falsely sold to us. What's now the European Union started out as the common market, and they sold it to us as a free trade area. It never was that from the beginning. It was a customs union, which is a slightly different thing anyway. But, you know, free trade sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, it's the same as sustainable development sounds good. But once you scratch beneath the surface, you find there are a lot of problems. And, of course, from the beginning, with the European Union or the common market, even though it was falsely sold to us as a free trade area, there always was a political agenda. And the people at the top, Mr. Heath in the case of Britain, and the other political leaders, knew that from the beginning. But they knew that it wouldn't be acceptable to the British people, and so it was sort of covered up and presented as a free trade area initially. We've gone on through successive treaties. So we've got to the point now where Britain makes only 20% of its own laws. The other 80% are made by the European Union.
Wow, and that has to be shocking. How many people in England are aware of that? We're going to break here for some stations to take a commercial break, and we'll be right back with Dr. David Abbott and talking about the European Union. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. Talking with Dr. David Abbott about England and the European Union. And while some stations have broken away, let's continue with our conversation and proceed, please, David.
I just want to correct you on one little thing, Michael. Of course, it's, you know, the United Kingdom is Britain and Northern Ireland, and Britain is England, Scotland, and Wales, and the Welsh and the Scots and the Northern Irish get slightly missed when we refer to the whole entity as England. And so it would be great if we could use the term Britain when we were talking to about the whole entity, you see.
Okay.
Or the United Kingdom would be even better.
Right.
But because this has it, the reason why I'm making this distinction is to do with regionalization policy, which we will talk about later on. But
thank you.
As I said, 20% of the laws are made at home by the British Parliament. The other 80% are imposed by the EU, and they're not even made by the European Parliament. They're made by bodies which are mostly the commissioners, the European commissioners, who are appointed, they're not elected, and they basically do the will of the bureaucrats who meet in smoke-filled rooms and decide what laws they're going to present to the commissioners. The role of the Parliament is only to rubber stamp, the European Parliament is just to rubber stamp those laws, and they then go out to the national parliaments, where they're either rubber stamped or completely bypass the Parliament and enter directly into national law. It's
wow.
A terrible system. It's completely the opposite of democracy.
Now, how many people, how many Britons understand that 80% of your current law is coming through a bureaucracy in Brussels?
Probably very few, but the number of people who understand that something very bad is going on at the European Union level is growing by the day. Now, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, it just shows you the failure of democracy in that the three main political parties in Britain all support Britain's continued membership of the European Union. And yet, polls have shown an increasing number of people who do not want to be in the European Union. And just very recently, there was a substantial independent poll done, and the people were asked, first of all, do you want to have a referendum on whether Britain should remain in the European Union? This is not whether Britain should join up with the Constitution, but whether Britain should actually remain in the European Union. And 62% said we should have a referendum.
62%.
They were then asked.
We'll be right back here at Freedom 21. We're back here with our guest, Dr. David Abbott, discussing the European Union and Great Britain, and he's described how the political parties are all the three largest political parties are all behind the European Union, but that how public support for the idea of remaining I guess it's not remaining, the public support for the European Union in general is eroding rather quickly.
That's right. And 50% of people said that they would vote to leave the European Union. 34% said they would vote to stay in, and the rest were the don't knows. So it's the first time we've had a majority wanting to actually leave the European Union. And, you know, at some point, the political politicians, the political elites have to realize this is what the people are thinking. Now, our party, my party, the UK Independence Party, is the only party that has from the beginning, from its inception 11 years ago, has campaigned for us, for Britain, to leave the European Union. Actually, we would like to see the European Union disintegrate for the sake not only of Britain, but also the other countries that are in it. They would all be much better off with a different sort of arrangement.
Well, the regionalization does standardize law everywhere, done by bureaucratic edict. It really transforms the whole Anglo-American dynamic that's gone on for centuries of expanding human liberty. This is the wholesale contraction of it, and of course they're warm and fuzzy to get control, and you know, the boot comes down later once you consolidate power like United Nations, the European Union, the World Trade Organizations, and the other global governance organizations would do, and as our leaders, every party in America supports these ideas generally. No party in America is standing against regionalization. So I'm very glad for the United Kingdom Independence Party. It is a party that that Americans must replicate and move forward with these kinds of independent ideas.
Yes, that's right. I would hate to see America get, you know, so sucked into NAFTA or CAFTA or the America's free trade area that they lost the amount of independence that Britain has already lost. We were very fearful that, and we still are fearful, that the Constitution would somehow be imposed on us, because then we would not have the possibility of leaving the arrangement without military action. But so far we're just bound in by treaties, and, you know, treaties get broken all the time. So if the right party, hopefully ours, or some combination of other parties, gets into power, we could break these treaties and restore sovereignty to Britain, start making our own laws again, and have an accountable government.
Well, how are you doing in respect to spreading the word to British citizens that they've lost control over their lawmaking, and as I understand it, even have lost control over their land use decisions at local levels to globalist regional organizations that are now making those decisions? How is it that that word is being spread?
Well, the print media are pretty good. There are several large circulation papers that realize, at least somewhat realize, how bad the situation is, and are spreading the word. The broadcast media are not very good. The BBC is popularly dubbed the Brussels Broadcasting Corporation. It gets a certain amount of funding, actually, from Brussels, although they claim it's for a sort of independent subsidiary. But you would think that the EU was nothing but a very good thing if you listen to the broadcast media. There are one or two small stations that challenge it. There's a station called Talk Sport, believe it or not, that has a political agenda that's more in line with ours. But generally, the broadcast media are pretty hopeless. The print media is good. The blogging community is fairly good. And, of course, our party's been trying to spread the word. And starting this fall, in late September, we're going to start a very big campaign to demand a referendum. We hope to get 1 million signatures to demand a referendum that on Britain's staying in the EU. In other words, we want to leave the European Union, and we hope to have enough popular pressure and support from the sympathetic print media that we can really make an impact and draw people's attention to how bad the current situation is.
Well, that has to be Tony Blair's worst nightmare.
Yes. Do you know, Tony Blair, before he became leader of the Labour Party, when he was standing for election at his constituency in the north of England, said, when we're in power, at that time the Tories were in power, when we're in power we will leave the European Union because the European Union is stealing British wealth and British jobs. And then once he got into power, he did a complete flip-flop, and now, of course, you know, he would secretly like to be the president of the European Union.
Well,
and he signed every document that they put in front of him, including the Constitution. You know, he signed the Constitution, but it has yet to be ratified by the UK.
My... Well, we've had shows earlier and talked about Tony Blair and his past chairmanship of the British Fabian Society.
Yes.
And, you know, it's one thing's very clear. If you're a real Fabian penetrator, there's no boundary imposed on you by truth.
No. Well put.
You know, there's a website that you pointed us to and that we have on our radio page tonight called, is it the Bruges Group?
A Bruges Group, yes. Bruges was the town in Belgium where Mrs. Thatcher made a speech at which she expressed regret at the European Union and urged changes.
Huh.
Bruges Group.
Well, they make the point that the European Union will ensure that national parliaments lose significant powers to European Union institutions, and that the European Union's powers into justice and home affairs will be expanded. The power over external border controls and internal security, that means homeland security, equivalent gets controlled by Brussels in England.
Well, it's already all immigration and asylum policy is decided in Brussels, all of it.
So Britain cannot make decisions about immigration policies without approval from the UN delegatee, the European Union. without their consent.
That's true. And this works in various ways, but asylum and immigration policy is entirely decided in Brussels. And if somebody gets into the country, they basically can never be thrown out because of the provisions in the human rights legislation. You know, Britain passed the Human Rights Act, which incorporates the European Convention on Human Rights, which is very similar to the UN Convention on Human Rights, but the same. And all sorts of unintended consequences have stemmed from that. Basically, no one can be deported. In fact, we have sitting in British jails at the moment people that are wanted in the States for terrorists, but because the States has the death penalty, they cannot be extradited to the U.S. because of the Human Rights Act.
My. Well, it is a clever plan. People used to think that it was just too preposterous to take seriously, but now wherever you look, the walls are closing in. They've certainly closed in more quickly in Britain than they have in the United States. You know, I made reference a bit ago to the Fabian Society. Let me read a quote that came out of the first edition of the American Fabian and get your reaction to it. This is written in 1895. And the author says, "We call our paper the American Fabian for two reasons. We call it Fabian because we desire to make it stand for the kind of educational socialist work which is so ably done by English Fabian Society. We call our paper the American Fabian because our politics must in a measure, differ from those of English Fabians. England and America are alike in some things, and some things they are utterly unlike. England's unwritten constitution readily admits of constant, though gradual, modification. Our American constitution does not readily admit such change. England can thus move into socialism almost imperceptibly. Our constitution, being largely individualistic, must be changed to admit of socialism, and each change necessitates a political crisis. That means the raising of great new issues."
Well, that's wonderful, isn't it? Of course, we call it salami slicing. You know, the introduction of socialism through the mechanism of the EU. It's all these, every little law that you can make, a new law that's made without there being any democratic input, and it's imposed on us. It may seem to have some benefit or some reason for it at the time, but the cumulative effect is the imposition of an extraordinarily rigid socialist doctrine on the whole country. However, we still like the cataclysmic catastrophes. 9/11 was called a beneficial crisis. So was the foot and mouth epidemic that we had in Britain, a beneficial crisis. And, you know, it's amazing how, for instance, after 9/11, they suddenly trot out all this pre-prepared legislation that can further, you know, suppress us, that they've had waiting on the books, waiting for an opportunity to wheel it out. And so we like we can do the salami slicing, but we also like the big event so that we can take a great step forward.
Well, you know, crisis seems to be the methodology for advancing this new paradigm. And you know, the people, you know, there's always this discussion of left-right divide, and you know, I'm increasingly convinced that the divide needs to be between ordinary people and the power crowds.
Exactly.
But, you know, when you look at people who have championed socialist ideas, we're now getting to the point where one can readily see that socialism does mean a police state.
Yes, it does. I mean, there are a lot of well-meaning socialists. And, in fact, in our party, we have a lot of people who are escapees from the Labour Party, who realize that, you know, socialism isn't power to the people, it's power to the elite, it is the development of a police state. We've had some terrible moves towards Britain becoming a police state in the last few months.
We'll be right back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Dr. David Abbott.
After spearheading efforts to implement the United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda in Santa Cruz, California, Congressman Sam Farr wrote,
"I am writing to congratulate you, the Advisory Board, and the Action Santa Cruz County Coalition for completing the local Agenda 21 Action Plan."
Congressman Sam Farr then wrote,
The local Agenda 21 action plan not only has local significance, it also will have regional and national impacts. As you know, the President's Council on Sustainable Development is beginning Phase 3 of its work, with an emphasis on sustainable communities.
Sam Farr continued.
I have been spearheading a similar effort to develop a process of sustainable development planning for the entire region.
So why does Sam Farr now say he's never heard of United Nations Agenda 21?
Yes, Congressman Farr, I'd like your my name's Daniel Beckett. I'd like your comments on the United Nations Agenda 21 program that you're implementing here. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But you endorsed it, sir. I have your paperwork.
United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda 21. If there's nothing to hide, why does Sam now deny it? This has been a public service question posed by Freedom 21 Santa Cruz at freedom21santacruz.net, inviting you to advance the cause of freedom in the 21st century. For more information about how you can advance the cause of freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Welcome back, Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. Some of our stations are still at break, so let me just remind the listeners who weren't with us for the first hour that a number of tools, neighborhood tools, have been developed for disseminating the information and coming to your own understanding of what Sustainable Development Agenda 21 is all about. You know, those tools include the Taking Liberty, Understanding the Wildlands Project, developed by Dr. Michael Kaufman, that'll really take you through how it is that our rural lands are being chewed up by the federal government and its partners. And then there's the recently issued CD called The War on Reason, 8 hours of interviews here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and don't forget the guide Understanding Sustainable Development Agenda 21. We're going to be right back here at Freedom 21. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our special guest, Dr. David Abbott. And David, can you tell us about the history of the common market and how we got to the European Union, and maybe draw some comparisons with what you see for American policy as it's being developed today?
Well, as I said, back in 1972, the then Labour Party took us into the common market. This was after Harold Macmillan of the Conservatives, who was a Fabian. All these people have been Fabians at one time or another in their life, it's true. We were taken in. It was supposed to be a free trade area. We signed the Treaty of Rome. Please our European partners even more, the night before they signed, Mr. Heath agreed to give away all Britain's fish. Europeans have used small nets and fished out the Mediterranean and fished out the coasts of Spain and France. We had 80% of the fish stocks, which had been sustained. It had been a sustainable catch for years. It's now handed over. It's called a community resource, and of course it's been decimated by the nets of the Spanish trawlers and so on. So that was things gradually progressed from there. We had various other treaties, including the Maastricht Treaty, and I just want to pause there for a moment, because by the time we got to the Maastricht Treaty, about 10 years ago, the penny was beginning to drop. There were patriotic people in Parliament who did not like this, and there were, in order for the Maastricht Treaty to get through Parliament, there was an enormous amount of arm-twisting and bribery and threats and bullying that took place, and it squeaked by a handful of votes. Now, it just reminded me of the description of the CAFTA vote, you know, which I think went by one or two votes, didn't it, through
yes.
Congress? And it just is following, the CAFTA thing is just exactly following in so many ways what happened with the development of the European Union. Maastricht introduced the regionalization concept. Then we had the Nice Treaty, and of course now we're on the verge of having the Constitution.
Let me ask you, how did that treaty bring about the regionalization policy?
It's in the Maastricht Treaty, and actually the official title of the European Union is the European Union of the Regions, and it established the Committee of the Regions, and these regions, which are substantial areas of each country, report directly to Brussels, bypassing the national parliaments. For instance, my region is the southeast region, and they have an office in Brussels, and they get grants from Brussels, which of course is just British tax money that's coming back to them after it's sloshed around in the leaky pipes of Brussels. You know, they establish a relationship with Brussels. They look to Brussels for funding, and so on and so forth.
And so they, in looking to Brussels for funding, they're writing their grant receipts based upon what it is Brussels wants to hear. And this regionalization policy is, as I'm always saying here in America, regionalizing America, whether it's air boards or water boards other kinds of advisory councils, are all established for the purpose of blurring political boundaries, because if you can blur the political boundary and raid the treasury, it's just a long-known axiom of politics that then you can gather the riches of all the people.
Yes, and that is exactly what's going on. And of course, you know, this regionalization has very sinister implications. It's even going to affect defense policy. The army is being restructured to fit into the regional structure, of course, the whole defense procurement thing is being geared to, they have to get all their kit from a European provider. I mean, one consequence of that is that whereas we used to buy a lot of things from America, we used to make a lot of stuff ourselves, but an F-16 costs, I think, about $20 million dollars. The European fighter, which isn't yet operational, and it's taken years and years and years in development, and it'll be out of date by the time we get it, is about three times that much. But we have to get that because it's European. It makes no sense.
Wow.
And it's going to undermine NATO, and it's going to drive a wedge between Britain and the U.S.
So these regionalizing organizations, whether it's the North American regionalization or the European regionalization, have enormous effects on other aspects of public policy that people might not anticipate.
Well, they do. And as Dr. Yates was saying, you know, it starts out as free trade, but hard on the heels of that is free movement of people. And we, you know, Britain is a crowded country. People have never been asked about whether they want more immigration, but we have an enormously growing population. You know, the countryside is being eaten up with new development to accommodate everybody. Everything's much more crowded. The roads are more crowded. The schools are more crowded and so on. Hospitals are crowded because there isn't the infrastructure to cope with the increased population.
So out of the EU, you're getting control of your trade policies, your immigration policies, your political processing policies. The essence of what makes an independent nation have been compromised.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, our history, the same as the history of America, is very different from other nations' history in that we have always been understood that you can do more or less whatever you want to do unless it's forbidden by the law. I mean, that's how sort of common law has grown up. Whereas the European model, which is the one that's now being sort of forced on us, is that you can only do what is allowed by your political masters. In other words, freedom is limited to what they say it can be. And that is a very significant basic difference between the British on the one hand and the continental Europeans on the other.
Well, that's the great glory of the thinking of John Locke and what preceded him and what came afterwards.
Exactly.
And what's happening is that mankind's greatest hope, the Anglo-American tradition of common law and the recognition of a natural law and a higher law, is all coming apart.
It's coming apart. I mean, the Human Rights Act, which I've mentioned before, some of the consequences of that, let me tell you. This, you know, is supplanting the sort of natural law, common law aspects of British law. Now, Mrs. Blair is a lawyer, Tony Blair's wife, Sherry, and she represented a 15-year-old Muslim girl who was at a school where I think almost everybody was a Muslim. The headmistress was a Muslim, and they had a dress code. You know, they had a school uniform, as is common in England and indeed in Britain, and it included being able to wear a Muslim outfit, but which left the face exposed. This girl wanted to wear the full Muslim gown, where you know peek out through the little thing that only shows the eyes, and she was represented by Mrs. Sherry Blair. Under the Human Rights Act, she got permission to do that, to wear this full Muslim gown. Now, the consequences of that are enormous, because it means that...
Hold that for a second, and we'll be right back here at Freedom 21. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Dr. David Abbott, talking about the European Union and its effect on Britons and Great Britain generally. And he's described the difference in the history of the development of European law and British law and subsequently American law as being key and essential to the whole dynamic of how it is that people lead their lives and how that's being eroded very rapidly by terms of the European Union in Great Britain. And specifically, as we broke back with the rest of our audience, he was describing how the is it the Commission on Human Rights, and
it's the European Convention on Human Rights,
and how it affects how it's showing itself in a particular case with dress codes at school.
That's right. And so this, you see, there are a lot of Muslim girls in Britain who would like, we believe, to be more integrated with the mainstream of British society. Of course, they're under pressure from their families very often not to do that and to, you know, wear the full Muslim gown and so on and so forth. And often they could say, well, the school uniform is this, so I have to wear it. But now, after Mrs. Blair won this case, it means that they can now have no weapon with which to withstand pressure from the family to go into this sort of exclusive Muslim mode, wearing the full Muslim gown. And that's only going to cause further disintegration of society. I mean, I mention this as one of the sort of, who could anticipate that as a consequence of the Human Rights Act, but there it is.
Well, of course, here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, we're hardcore advocates of the relationship between a parent and a child. But I think what this illustration points out to me nonetheless is that the policies, the immigration policies, the follow-up trade policies, the open border policies are designed to disorient societies. The immigrating society as well as the established society, when it happens at the pace that immigration has been happening at in England or immigration here in the United States. It's just beyond a culture's ability to absorb and amalgamate. And this is understood by those who are promoting these policies, and it's designed in order to create the kind of division and hostility that makes regionalization and centralization of power simpler. Talk about the EU in terms of corruption. I mean, we hear a lot, increasing amount anyway, about how the United Nations has been found to be corrupt in so many ways. Is the European Union a more efficient model of a global governance dynamic?
It is intensely corrupt. The they have a court of auditors who are supposed to audit the books every year. They have failed to pass the audit for the last 10 years in a row. 10 years. There are billions and billions and billions unaccounted for. There are over 2,000 overseas bank accounts that the EU maintains, and nobody knows what they're for. There's a lot of nepotism. The expense account fiddling is just extraordinary and recognized. And if somebody blows the whistle, they get fired. There have been 3 whistleblowers who have, lost their jobs because they pointed out what was going on. They appointed one of the British commissioners, Neil Kinnock, who was an ex-leader of the Labour Party, to head an anti-corruption drive, and it was a complete and utter joke. I mean, his wife also works for the EU, as does one of his children. I mean, once you get in there, you can you fix for life, and you're also immune from prosecution. The people that work for the EU cannot be prosecuted, and that's a lifetime protection. Their premises can't be searched, and so they can get away with whatever they want to get away with. It is the beginnings of an extraordinarily corrupt arrangement.
Well, it's a legalized mob.
Yeah.
I mean, one really can't expect public-private partnerships, that is, the power of force combining with their buddies, not to become just that.
No. And that's what it is. You see, the big organizations have the lobbying power to influence the legislation at the level of the bureaucrats that make the laws that go to the Commission. This is one of the reasons why the vitamin directive, you see, has been able to go through, because the sort of mom-and-pop operations that supplied many of the vitamins in Britain, the same as they do in the States, are going to be unable to afford all the testing that is required to be able to sell vitamins throughout the European Union, and so and other food supplements. And so, you know, they were able to put the small businesses out of business by their lobbying power. They say that if you're working in the European Union and you feel slightly hungry, you can just look round and there'll be a lobbyist waiting to buy you lunch wherever you want to go.
Wow.
And they're completely unregulated, as in the U.S. You know, lobbyists have to register. There, in Brussels, there are 15,000 lobbyists unregistered, and nobody knows what they're getting up to. But one thing is that they're all supporting people who can afford lobbyists, if you see what I mean.
I understand that. And meanwhile, the regulations that come out of that destroy small businesses and the families that that rely on those small businesses for jobs, and it harms all of us as consumers, because it's going to have an increasingly downward effect on our standards of living. And I think most Americans understand how the middle class in Europe has been getting thinner and thinner, and we begin to see our own middle class being peeled back layer by layer. While we continue to subsidize what I call the sustainable mercenaries who take money and go out and take college PhDs and have them study the movement of frogs. And,
yes.
And, you know, I had a an environmental magazine that came across my desk last week that was entitled Toad Tunnels and Big Victory in U.S. Congress. And they were so pleased because the Congress had allocated $3 billion for the construction of toad tunnels. I'm not joking. I'm talking about tunnels that go under roads so that toads can pass. So that's how our economy in the United States is being buoyed up. And of course, you can't print out funny money and give it for ditch digging efforts and have it sustain itself. And so I'm beginning to think increasingly that this whole sustainable development movement is a guise to cover up a failing monetary system, where the guys who are in control of this monetary system don't want to lose power, and so they're telling us all to get used to shortage and crisis while they create this crisis in an effort to maintain their power. And everything I hear about England or Britain tends to confirm that observation.
Well, you know, they say that there have been a lot of jobs created in Britain in the last since the present government has been in, but almost all of those new jobs are in government, and almost all of those jobs are doing things that are mandated one way or another by EU regulations. And you know, the cost you mentioned, the cost of compliance, it's been estimated that the cost of complying with the regulations for a small company is seven times what it, you know, per unit of production, what it is for a large company. So you can see how the imposition of these regulations favors the large companies at the expense of the small companies. And, you know, we're getting this sort of horrible combination between capitalism and the fascist European state.
Well, you know, we've had a guest, Terry Hayfield, who will contend that British-American capitalism is exactly that, designed to create a global corporate socialism that then goes into an even worse economic dynamic for human beings, and this style of capitalism, corporate capitalism, does not rely on the principles of free trade and private property.
No.
It's not about engaging with your fellow human being on a mutually satisfactory basis. It's about rules, regulations, conformity, and carrots and sticks. Sticks for those who don't conform, and carrots for those who do. It reminds me of the poor victims of their own government in the Gaza Strip, just having their homes torn down in front of their eyes, and those who didn't like it were even put in jail.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Gaza Strip, I mean, they were... it wasn't that long ago, 30 years ago, that the Israeli government encouraged those settlers to go there. And then they've been there 30 years, and then they uproot them and toss them out. And meanwhile, they're going to, establish all the Palestinians there, and with new housing provided by somebody or another. I mean, you have mentioned the Pathfinder scheme in the north of England, where Mr. Prescott, who is the Deputy Prime Minister, is seeking to destroy some well-established communities with brick-built houses and replace them with modern, probably high-rise housing, which is going to completely disorient the local community, and it, for the purpose, apparently, of saving a little bit of electricity, rather than insulating the existing houses, which could be done much, much cheaper, whole communities are going to be destroyed. This gives the government, I think, control over communities with this, when you uproot them like this. And, you know, that sort of thing has been going on in Britain with the development of new towns and so on for quite a long time, and it seems to be gathering pace.
Well, and that program has begun here in the United States. Of course, the one that's famous is the Kelo case, the eminent domain case out of Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
But right here in Santa Cruz, mobile home parks aren't allowed to be improved, and then they're condemned and demolished, and people then are put into government housing, and rules are strict, and and the edict, the statement from those who operate these confines is, well, if you don't like our rules, you better start. And that's the attitude. The attitude is that people are chattel, and the infrastructure of what I call the post-private property era is being built with the dollars that are going to bury our monetary system in debt. And so we lose on both sides of the coin. And yet, in one very sad way, to date, we've been sanctioning our own victimhood. But it seems to me that awareness is growing, and you seem to be confirming that in England. Talk a little bit about how the United Independent...
UK Independence Party.
Yes.
Yeah. We are 11 years old. We have fought all the elections in the last 11 years, all the national elections, and the European elections. Now, we do not approve of proportional representation. We think that's an insult to the British way of doing things. I mean, you should elect somebody and you know who's representing you. But the European system is that you have a party list, and it's a form of proportional representation. That, of course, favors small parties. And in the elections last year, 2004, for the European Parliament, we had 12 MEPs elected. In some areas, we were the second most successful party, and overall, we got 17% of the vote. You know, and this is when you think that there are three well-established parties, that was a tremendous success. We rattled the establishment at that time, and it was as a consequence of our doing so well in that election that Mr. Blair promised that we would have a referendum on the election. In fact, what he said is, that is a government promise. So, of course, subsequently he said we weren't going to have one, but so we know what government promises are worth.
At least they're from Tony Blair.
Yeah, but we think that he chatted to the French, Monsieur Chirac, and so Chirac said, oh, he'd have a referendum for the French people, everybody assuming the French would vote wholeheartedly for it. But they did, this was a referendum on the Constitution, not on staying in the European Union. I'm talking about a referendum on the European Constitution. So the French had their referendum, and of course, the French people voted against it. And indeed, that influenced the Dutch referendum, which followed shortly behind, and that they voted against it. So it really did, we think, we take credit in our party for having sort of turned the tide of history by doing well in the European elections last year.
Well, I think it's that kind of bootstrap effort that has served humanity so well over the eons, and now is the time for us to give one big thrust to do exactly the kind of things that you and so many other people in Britain are doing. We've got about 10 minutes left in our show. If you've got a question for Dr. Abbott, our phone number is 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Well, the regional assemblies that you've discussed a bit in England, explain how a regional assembly works, where the authority comes from, and the kinds of things that these Brussels-directed regional assemblies do.
Well, it's interesting. Of course, Wales got voted to have a regional assembly. It is already, there was a certain movement wanting to have some measure of independence. The government spent a lot of money persuading the Welsh to vote that way, and they just squeaked it through. Like so many of these things, they just squeak through. It's most peculiar. The Scots have their own parliament, which is a form of regional assembly, very corrupt as it turns out, and the Northern Irish do too. Splitting up England was a lot trickier, and the government set up these bodies, but they're extrajudicial. I mean, there is no statute that have set these bodies up. They're private corporations. It is the most extraordinary arrangement. And they are incurring, they're taking on staff with pension arrangements and so on and so forth. And we believe that the assembly people that are authorizing this are going to become personally liable for some of the obligations that they're taking on. It's a very interesting situation. It is another layer of bureaucracy. And they have several functions, but the main one is planning policy, as you say, and they do talk about sustainable development. I have to say, Michael, that until you alerted me to this phrase, it had passed me over, but it's in all their literature, sustainable development.
And yet they'll go into any community anywhere in the world and say, this is a local program. You know, this global to local is always a local program, but if you go two counties over, you find they got the same document that you've got. I mean, we've had guests and callers from all over the country saying, we really got onto this when we found out that across the state, this independent idea designed for our county was being sold to these other people by the same salesman.
Yeah.
So it's it seems that in England, while you're doing it through Brussels, here we take on the local regionalization actually through our federal government, which of course is a major breach of the separation of powers and the idea of state authority.
Well, I used to be active in sort of local affairs in Oregon, and I remember 10 years or more ago going to a meeting about the future of the town I lived in then. It was called a visioning meeting. And
watch out for that. If you haven't heard that term, audience, of visioning, listen to what Dr. Abbott's about to tell us.
Well, then I go to a meeting of the South East of England Regional Assembly. It's the same deal. You know, they're all reading from the same playbook.
That they are. And I think that playbook is the same in Britain as it is in the United States.
Yes.
We have Fred, caller on the line. Fred, do you have a question for Dr. Abbott?
Yes, good evening. Some people see all of these people that are trying to do us ill and ascribe it to satanic forces. Do you have any thoughts along that line?
Well, I don't. I had a number of people contact me during the election, actually, and they claim that some of these things connected with the EU are to do with satanic forces, and I must say, they make quite good cases. I mean, for instance, the EU building has been built to resemble Bruegel's picture of the Tower of Babel, and the statue outside shows Europa being raped by the bull and so on. I mean, there are some peculiar things, and the EU star symbols are supposed to be some sort of symbol of the devil. But I have me doubts about that. You may have some further insights into it, but it's not an area that I'm very expert in.
No, I don't know how to judge that. There are other people that talk about the occult organizations and many people that participate in that.
Yes, I've heard about this, but I've had no personal experience of it or reason to believe it one way or the other. I'm sorry.
I guess we could just account for it by the common greed that's going around and the lust for power.
There's certainly a lust for power, isn't there? Yes.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling, Fred. You know, it strikes me on that subject that that while there may be some real, I'm sure there's some real evil at the root of this, and I'm sure there's some real secrecies at the root of this, we can find the indicting circumstances just from their own paperwork and from their own political philosophy that they express. And once we understand that, there's nothing that we have to speculate about. You know, the goods are there. The globalist agenda needs to be rejected. We need to transition it out of America. We need, you know, you're working to transition it out of England, and that's that. And once it's all exposed, that evil rot will just crawl back into the woods where it belongs. We're going to welcome back some audiences here in just a few seconds, and I want to remind our audience that if you want to know more about sustainable development, go to our website, F21SC.net, and go to our store where you can find some handy tools. And welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. We're here for the last few minutes of our show tonight with Dr. David Abbott, having discussed the European Union and really the disintegration of Britain's legal and foreign policy and immigration authority over its own nation. These rules and edicts are now coming out of Brussels as part of the European Union. And in these last few minutes, David, what is it you'd like to leave with the audience in terms of understanding these dynamics and what people need to be aware of and what it is they can or should do?
Well, I think we need to hang on to democracy. I think we need to be extremely wary of any organization that doesn't, we don't choose who governs us. I mean, that's a very basic thing for us Anglo-Saxons, as they call it, to be able to choose who governs us and how they govern us, and to be able to get rid of them if we don't like it. We've lost all that with these transnational organizations. I mean, the European Union is one of the worst, but there are others. They are all corrupt. They're following their own agenda. They're being run for the benefit of the elites that think them up. There are a number of websites which I'd like to possibly leave with your audience, Michael. You've mentioned the bruisegroup.com. And there's another one that I think is very good called TFA.net. That stands for the Freedom Association. And that is the leader of the Freedom Association is a man who was a Maastricht rebel. I talked to how they were all pressured to vote for the Maastricht Treaty. He was one of the few that held out against all the pressure that was being put on everybody at that time. It was a terrible time in the history of Britain, really. TFA.net. And my own one that's going to be coming up soon is BritsWorldwide.org, and the only bit that's up at the moment is my blog, so it's BritsWorldwide.org/blog. Anyway, I just thought I'd get that little add in, and there's also UKIP.org, UKIP.org. Those are all websites that deal in one way or another with the European Union.
Well, there's so much that Americans can learn about the true nature of the European Union, not what we hear on CNN and Fox News, but what the European Union really is doing to England. And
yes.
You've been a great insight for sharing that with us, as was Robert Theobald several months ago, who discussed some aspects of the European Union also. It is from learning from your experience that we can avoid getting ourselves as deep into this hot water as Brits have, and we want to work and coordinate with across both sides of the Atlantic to resurrect the ideals that were so well established and were fought so hard by Brits over so many centuries, and then by Americans, and all of that is, as we've said, is just slipping away as the idea of natural law is being overridden with legal positivism, rules, and the rules always benefit the rule makers and begin to squeeze down the liberties of each individual.
They do, and of course they're rewriting history as well. That's another way that they're able to do these kind of things, by rewriting history. They're constantly talking about reuniting Europe. Europe has never been united except under the Roman Empire.
Wow. Well, maybe that's their goal. I mean, we clearly know that the goal of the elites is to wrap us all up into one ball, and they've got plenty of money to buy their agents to go out and do that. And if you are involved in sustainable development programs, and that's where your income comes from, you know, you don't have to drop cold. You've got to just think through what you're doing and find a way to transition your own efforts. You know, if you're in schools, find a way to dig through and really present the history, not the history that the government textbooks are giving us and throwing down our children's throats. You know, we need to look at real documents and real history and get the real truth out, and that way this manipulated play isn't going to work. Doctor, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and just thank you very much.
Michael, thank you very much for having me. It was great.
Well, and tonight, that concludes our show for tonight, and we wish to look forward to you next week here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to the second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and my co-host, Roy Avila, is just...
I'm floored. I'm floored. That was just one of the most incredible hours that I have spent on this program.
Well, you know, we find those hours because there's a lot of people in this country who've been spending a lot of years really thinking and digging in, and now it's becoming that the warnings that they gave decades ago have now become clear, and so it's so easy to put these people in front of the American public and say, here's where we are, here's how we got here, this is where they're taking us, and now we've got to ask ourselves, what are we going to do? And well, that's a subject for future and
well, and I think for people who caught it, were fortunate enough to catch it, tell your friends, go to the F21SC.net website, and we'll have it up. They can listen to it. You know, equally, I've been looking at America's Choice, Liberty, or Sustainable Development, the DVD. It's equally as strong. I mean, in a few CDs, you really get what's going on.
Well, that thing is selling from a lot of sources around the country, and it's selling well, and that's comforting because as the word begins to spread, we're going to drop out of this Democrat, Republican, left, right, conservative, liberal divide and get ourselves focused on what it means to continue the American experience for the benefit not just of ourselves and our children, but really for posterity and for all of humanity. Because if America goes down the route that we're slipping, the globalist route, there's going to be nothing left in the world to hold humanity up from the separation of a ruling elite and the rest of us being made into drones living in echo villages. Well, that kind of ties into this hour's topic, does it not? We've got Robert Theobald, who's been with us before, in fact, was a contributor to the War on Reason series, something that you can order from Freedom 21 Santa Cruz's e-commerce section. We're beginning to grow that e-commerce section, so it's worth your look, and certainly if you don't and haven't seen the Guides to Understanding Sustainable Development, you want to read it online and presumably order some so that you can begin to distribute it and circulate it in your communities.
Well, like Patrick said, the more you know, the less complicated it becomes.
Well, that's true. And if you look at it from the macro perspective, you can begin to identify all the little fingers that are in this community, in your community, in every community in this country and increasingly even around the world. So, what we're going to talk about tonight is regionalization in England. Robert Theobald is a British citizen, and England is ahead of us in this process. Tony Blair is a mainstay in the global movement. We've talked about his Fabian socialist connections, and before we get started, I'll read a quote from Tony Blair. This was made in a speech he made in 1997 to the Earth Summit Second Conference from the United Nations. He said, 5 years ago, the Rio Summit launched Agenda 21. Since then, 70% of our local authorities have been inspired to think global, act local through local Agenda 21, but we must do more. I want all local authorities in the UK to adopt local Agenda 21 strategies by the year 2000. Well, that's why we need to know what's going on over in Great Britain, because what they do there usually follows here. That's because we're on the same global string. So it's good to have Robert back with us to update us on where the sustainable engine in Great Britain is driving to now.
Hello, hello, Michael, yes?
Yes, sir, Robert, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I don't know where you want to start, Michael, but do you want to talk about the Echo Cities in China, or do you want to talk about the regionalization first?
Well, why don't we talk about Echo Cities in China? And my gosh, what would Great Britain and a fellow from England have to say about such far off issues?
Well, it's very very interesting because about 10 days ago we had the president of China came to London. I don't know if you picked that up in the United States, but he was over here, and we heard on the news that. He was going to sign about £150 million worth of contracts with Britain, and then almost immediately that figure went up to £750 million, which is over $1 billion, I believe.
Right.
Well over. Now the Chinese president signed to have some the Airbus. Aircraft, which is the European aircraft, but the main thing that I wanted to talk to you about was the eco cities, because there's a company in Britain called OVARUP, and I'll just spell that for you. It's OVE, new word, ARUP, and that's a consulting engineers, very well established. So they've got a contract to design 20 eco-cities in China, and that was signed when the Chinese president was here. Now it's interesting because on the television when you had the Chinese president there, he sat next to Lord Faulkner. Now Lord Faulkner is Tony Blair's he used to be his roommate in his student days, and he's a Blair crony. Blair made him into the Lord Chancellor, which is a very high position. So you had Lord Faulkner, you had the Chinese president, and then you had the representative from OVARUP. And I'll just tell you about one of the main one that we have here is that I've been able to check up on is Dang Tong. I don't know if I've spelt it right. It's Dong Tan, Dongtan, and it's near. It's in the estuary, or it will be in the estuary of the Yangtze River. That's just opposite to Shanghai, and it's a sustainable city. They flag it as a sustainable city to attract commerce and leisure pursuits. It's three quarters of the size of Manhattan. Now at the moment it's mostly agricultural land, and it's next to a huge wetland of global importance now, where various wildlife lives, you see. So they're going to build this new city here. Now the interesting thing was I checked up on the OVARUP website, and back in April they had a meeting. And they had a conference in Kuala Lumpur, and all kinds of people were at that conference, and it was sponsored by the United Nations Environmental Programme, the CTNC. I'm not sure what that is actually, but also it was sponsored by European Union. And also by ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Excuse me, got a bad throat. So that was in Kuala Lumpur in April. That seems to have been the shop window for this Eco City project. And OVARUP has got lots of offices in the Far East, all over. They've got them in Hong Kong and Malaysia and many, many places there.
Now, OVARUP is a British engineering firm?
Yeah, they're a consulting engineers, Michael. They're very, very well established. They do very, very high-profile design of very, very high-profile civil engineering contracts civil engineering contracts. That's what they're good at. And they're a long established firm, but they've got into this sustainable thing. Now, it's going to be now it's a partnership thing, of course, as you might have imagined. It's always a partnership thing, isn't it?
Between government and engineering firm, yes.
That's right, and it's they see it as a template for China and elsewhere in the world, and they're going to do the usual. It's going to be done in this usual way. They're going to do economic and business planning. Now, this will interest you especially. Social development. Sustainable building design, the architecture, the infrastructure, the renewable energy process implementation, the waste management, sustainable energy management, planning, urban design. That's the things that OVALP are going to be involved with.
Well, I see here that it's to include social development.
That's right.
So what you've got is a mass undeveloped piece of land, contract in China, being given to an English company to come in and stack the people in the smart growth model, and presumably assign them the jobs and make them the drones for the international corporate interests that are doing the, quote, sustainable development on a much smaller scale. We have the same thing happening here in Santa Cruz City with a little sustainable village being built out at Natural Bridges by a developer from San Jose. So on a much smaller smaller scale, you see the same dynamic, and with the social engineering fitting right into the purview, supposedly, of an engineering firm. And that's what strikes me as the most bizarre thing in the world.
This OVALP seems to be extremely well connected with the sustainable development concepts, and they've done an awful lot of work, it seems to me, to pursue these contracts, you know, and they've got the contract with China, you see.
Well, this is Roy Avila. They're doing a lot of work. They've also founded a foundation that, after their founder died in 1988, the foundation now, his overall mission is encapsulated in his deed of trust. This is for the advancement of education directed towards the promotion, furtherance, and dissemination of knowledge of matters associated with the built environment. They pursue the objectives in acknowledgments of Sir, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, Ove's contribution over many decades, with the emphasis on the multidisciplinary nature of design and engineering and architecture. And this is what they're also teaching. Their principal focus is within postgraduate and undergraduate education, promoting new thinking and initiatives that they are likely to reach with a wide audience all around the world.
Well, that certainly is the prototype doctrineer of the sustainable development sales guys, and whether they're selling to planning models or selling to educational dictates, that is the language you hear everywhere.
Yeah. While we had the president of China over in London, Michael. There's another interesting thing, of course, involved with China, because we had an article in the Sunday Telegraph, and it's entitled "Tony Cozies Up with Tyranny." It was an article by he's referring to an article by Jonathan Mirsky, headed "A Gangster Comes to Town." Mr. Minsky contrasted the deferential welcome to London planned for the President of China by Tony Blair with China's record as one of the worst ruthless dictatorships in the world. It says here, among China's crimes, he cited the regime's murderous treatment of Tibetans, Christians, Muslims, dissidents and strikers. And he mentions that they've got these execution vans they go around doing extrajudicial executions, more than 3,000 a year in China. And the other very, very disturbing thing is that China has gone in with the European Union for this Galileo global positioning satellite, and they've got a 20% stake in that. This is going to be a military thing, and it's also going to be for checking up on everything. For example, they want to put a chip in everyone's car, every car in Europe, that will be checked out by the Galileo global positioning satellite, so they can charge you how many miles you've driven or where you are and all this, you know. So China's a partner in that, which we find rather disturbing.
Well, you've raised a number of points here. I mean, for me, and it's always been this analysis, you begin with the fact that Chinese government is a totalitarian government.
Yeah.
People in America are flooding the Chinese government with huge amounts of our currency, and presumably from the stories that you're now telling us, that currency is turning around, buying English firms to go out and build the New World Order communist or eco village, where people are made into drones and made to believe they're second to the to the reptiles and amphibians that surround their living quarters, but which must be treated and revered at all times. This environmental movement becomes a religion, and the public-private partnerships becomes the way for a narrowing elite to control us all. And then you get the social justice, which is nowhere more fully implemented than in China, with the kinds of deadly inhuman policies that the Chinese government is now known for almost six decades.
That's right.
It's quite disturbing that the British American world is falling prey to the folly that's taking us down, and trade policies that result in the building up of a totalitarian government working against their own people and potentially working against the interests of people around the world continues to happen without people taking note and without our media giving us warning and information.
Well, I will say that the British newspapers are doing a much better job than we are here in the States. I'm looking at Tuesday's San Jose Mercury News, and there's a front page article about our governor in China, emphasizing the importance of cooperating with China to better California.
Well, I think I've been talking to some of my friends about the newspapers recently, and from what I understand, Michael, our newspapers are a little bit fuller than the American newspapers. But you do have a good advantage over us insofar as you have the internet radio, which is very, very well developed. So I think that you have the edge on us there. But our press is a bit better than yours.
Well, as we talked privately, and as we talked on the last time you were on the show, it's so important to share the information and the experiences from Britain to America and from America to Britain, because the globalists have us in the same soup, and the patterns become easy to recognize, and that helps us cause a greater number of our fellow citizens in both countries to understand what we're up against as we begin to figure out what to do about it.
Now, I've just got one or two more things to say about this the Chinese thing. At the present moment, Tony Blair is the president of the European Union. As you probably know, it's every 6 months it changes. So Tony's been cozying up to the Chinese, and he's been involved with this development of the Galileo satellite, and the Chinese have got their part in it. But the new president is going to be the Prime Minister of Finland, the next one, in I don't know when it is, in 2-3 months, I think. Now, he's very, very concerned about that, because he thinks that this Chinese satellite, the Galileo European Chinese satellite, is going to be damaging NATO. Now, he's completely of the opposite opinion of Blair on that, so it seems. So there's going to be some things to watch out for there. And I've also got a report here talking about General Lance Lord. He's U.S. Air Force Space Command. He said that the Americans are planning to deploy an electronic warfare unit capable of jamming enemy satellites, you see. So I wonder which one that would be. Maybe it would be the Galileo. So that's in a recent report in one of our newspapers.
Well, sitting on this side of the ocean, I look over toward Europe, and the leader that worries me the most is Tony Blair.
Oh, he's actually we have endless newspaper reports about him, and he's an actor. Of course, actually, he went to school in the northeast of England, and you had a gentleman on. You had Rodney Atkinson on Radio Liberty earlier in the year, and he went to school with Blair, and when Blair was in Blair's primary school, and he will tell you that the headmaster said that Blair was always, even as a boy, he was always calling everything into question and trying to change everything. It's a part of his nature. It's in him, and he's always been like that ever since he was a boy. And he's a play actor as well. Have you ever heard about the business? He lapses off into amazing lies, you know. For example, he said that this is a fact. He said this on television, I think it was. When he was a lad in Newcastle, he said that he stowed away on a plane going to the Bahamas when he was a lad, you see. That was what he said. But in actual fact, they said, well, it could never have happened because there had never been any plane flying out of Newcastle going to the Bahamas. And certainly not when Blair was a boy. So that was a complete figment of his imagination. And the other famous thing he said was about football. He was talking about Newcastle football team, and he was saying when he was a lad, he used to watch I think it was Jackie Milburn, a famous footballer, and he used to be sitting in the seats watching Jackie Milburn. But in actual fact, They pointed out that when Blair was a boy, there never was any seats in the Newcastle football ground. It was standing room only. So that was another lie he made. He does this all the time, Michael. He's got this streak of fantasy in him, you see, but it's dangerous.
Well, sure, it's dangerous. We've got the same sort of fantastic images that pop into American politicians' minds, and I think that's why Americans have begun increasingly to tune a lot of it out, because these people don't have credibility, and I think it's worrisome that we do tune them out, because they not only not have credibility, they have become truly dangerous for...
That really kind of brings me on to something that... that I've been studying about the Fabians, actually, and there's a Fabian front organisation in Britain called the Federal Trust. Obviously, it's promoting European federalism, and they pointed out in 1997, from 1997 onwards, which is when Blair comes to power, they said as the stakeholders rise in importance, the electoral turnout has declined. So people just aren't voting in the same numbers now. And that was the Federal Trust, which is a Fabian front organisation, which observed that. You see?
Very interesting. Of course, for the audience that doesn't know what Fabians are, let's give a moment of explanation. The Fabian socialists began and organized themselves in London back in the 1880s, and have had huge influences both in British and in American political and business life for 125 years now. They practice what they call a program of permeation and penetration and permeation, and that's how they're able to get all their fingers down to the local level. They come up with cute little ploys like stakeholder councils that you just made mention of, and which employ Fabian ideology, oftentimes by people who don't even know what a Fabian socialist ideology is all about. So they're able to conscript people into their mesh, all by fooling them on one subject or another subject, just so long as the victim, if you will, becomes a participant in one aspect or another of their formulation and objective. And Tony Blair is the past chairperson of the British Fabian Socialist Society. So much for people who say the Fabians faded away 50 years ago. The British Prime Minister himself is a Fabian. So we can readily presume that Fabian ideology and policy has a whole lot to do in today in British politics. And I think we could contend that it is really much of the ideology that drives the entire globalist movement. You find the Fabians connected here, there, and everywhere.
Well, in actual fact, Mark, just twice recently, when I don't watch television very much, but twice recently I've been watching the news, and I've seen various political people making statements, and they're in the background, one was Mandelson and the other one, I can't remember the other one, but in the background were the banners of the Fabian Society. Now I always understood that they always did things pretty stealthily, but they seem to be getting quite cheeky now. That's twice I've seen their banners on the TV. I've got a really good quote here for you, Michael, from 1943, a Fabian quote. This is from Margaret Cole, and she was the wife of G.D.H. Cole. He was a Fabian historian and an economist. And this is what Margaret Cole wrote. She said, Fabians appeared in so many desirable liberal and cultural connections that they could scarcely be believed to be subversive of private property or of liberty.
My. Well, today the attack on private property is clear. You can easily trace it to Fabian thought. Although it needs to be understood in a little different context than the way the average left liberal thinks of it, and that is that as Fabian ideology has evolved, it has incorporated the notion of what they now call public-private partnerships, combining business with government as opposed to simply have government be the business. That was Mussolini's plan, and it worked a whole lot better than Stalin's plan did from an economic perspective. And so that has become a cornerstone in the Fabian ideology. It's to move towards social justice and get rid of equal justice and always wrap itself in the flag of the environment. And then conduct business through a partnership dynamic, government-private partnerships. Those who are buddies, chummy, and working toward the socialist objective can take their place as business purveyors. And we're seeing that right down to the local level. Whether you're in Chicago, as I was last week, it was very apparent, or here in Santa Cruz, throughout the country. And that's why free enterprise, and that's why the ranchers and the farmers are having a tough time in this country, is because this ideology is stealthily moving through, even if they're being bold enough to fly their banners on your TVs in England. When it comes to how it combs the countryside, how it permeates our institutions, it is very stealth indeed.
It's extremely stealthy. We've got a terrible problem here now in Britain. We've got so many civil servants now. They keep and the number of them keeps increasing all the time. They reckon that every family in this country will pay out £30,000. That must be about $50,000, just to service the pension debt of the civil servants. So that's a huge sum that's round everybody's neck now. Where this terrible bureaucracy, which is also associated with Fabianism, as keeps permeating everywhere.
Well, here in Santa Cruz, the big story this year, one of the few outbreaks of real news that we've seen in our newspaper, is about the enormous increases over the last 3 years of government workers' pensions. And, again, I say, I think you've said, as England goes, America follows shortly thereafter. So your warning of the increasing ominousness of that condition is something we can look forward to as well.
Regarding regionalization, which of course is a thing that the Fabians promoted right from a long time back, we're seeing that very, very much now on a local level. In our local paper, in our local paper the other day, they're now talking about regionalization of the police force.
My,
you see, now,
that's one I haven't heard here in the United States yet. I've heard of everything else being regionalized, but regionalized police force.
Well, I'll just tell you a little bit about it, Michael. They've got eight regions in England, and they've got Wales, and then there's London. Now, what they've done is they've floated some different suggestions of how they want to do this, because they always like to think that they always like you to think that you've got a choice about these matters, you see. So they give you various possibilities. Now,
and everything is always voluntary, so long as you do
what
you're told.
Yeah, they will consult, you see, and then they'll say, well, people wanted this or people wanted that. But basically, we're very concerned because at the moment we've got 43 police forces in England and Wales, and where I live, it's the Bedfordshire Constabulary, and I can go up to the meeting of the committee, the watch committee, and I can ask a question there if I want to. The chief constable will be there, and various big wigs will be on that committee, and I can stand up and ask my question. But once we've got this regionalisation of the police force, that possibility is taken farther and farther away from me, and we're very concerned about that.
What do you see in terms of citizen response and reaction, and is that something that about which the populace can be mobilised to fight regionalisation?
The trouble is, Michael, that when we're talking about something like this, for example, there'll be a group of people that are interested in what's happening and motivated and trying to understand about it. But the vast majority of the people, they will just get on with their lives, their jobs, and doing all the things they've got to do in their everyday life, and they won't take a lot of notice. And that's a terrible shame. We're moving towards a national police, if you like, and we've never had that in Britain.
Well, a police state is much easier to administer if you centralise the police force.
It is much easier, and that's what we're very, very concerned about. The other thing, of course, just even on our local level, there's been in our local newspaper, we've been talking about the regionalisation of the fire service as well. Now, where I live in the east of England, there's six counties, and each one of those has got its own fire service. And if you've got a fire, you ring up 999 and you'll be put onto the county fire control. And if you sort of say, well, you know, I live on Home Farm, they know exactly where you are, because they know the ground, you see, and they'll send the fire engine round, and they'll find you. But of course, what this vast new area that they want to have an automated control, and you know, for example, in our area, there must be about 20 George Streets or even more than that. So there's going to be some terrible mix-ups. But this is all on the regional dictate. You see, we've got to do it because Brussels says we've got to do it. You see, so that's another concern as well.
And what reasons are they giving you locally for doing it?
Oh, they don't give you many reasons. They just say we've got to have it because it's rationalisation and it's going to be, you know, modernisation. That's a very useful word.
Around here they say, well, we're running out of money, so it'd be easier for us to do.
Yeah, that's right. They use those sorts of excuses because on planning, we always used to call it town and country planning here. Well, in other words, that was how it was called. But now, of course, it's called spatial planning, and that comes from a German phrase, spatial planning. We now had spatial planning, but anyway, basically the planning, the town and country planning, is out of the hands of my local authority. It's out of the hands of the county now. It's in the hands of the regional assembly. You see, they're the ones who dictate everything. They're the ones who dictate where, for example, north of my town, they want to build a new development with 40,000 houses on it. So that's
are these single family homes, or are these?
I don't know how it will be, Michael, but. There'll be lots of small homes. There'll be lots of small places because one of the things of modern life is, of course, there's so many divorces now, and then you have these very small little houses like rabbit hutches sometimes, you know, and they build lots of those. So just to tell you that the planning is out of our hands, really. At a local level, there's nothing we can do about it.
And it's into the hands of regionalized stakeholding councils that sort of appoint themselves and by Brussels. Is that
it's quite amazing. The way that the assembly is organized is quite amazing. Actually, you've got the secretariat which runs it. And they've got so many different mechanisms. Really, they can constitute the thing how they want. Really, I mean, say for example, a particular say there was a councillor from my town, from Luton, which there was, and his party in the town council lost the control of the town council to the other party, which is what happened. Now. He didn't disappear off the regional assembly. They just inducted him they can just take anybody in there that they want to. You see,
just appoint him. Okay,
just appoint him. Yeah, that's right. So
it's how the federal office here, the resource conservation district works. They just appoint the folks, and then they administer this huge grants of monies that come from government or from the Packard Foundation, and then they begin to change how it is that various aspects of the community are allowed to live.
It's exactly the same here. We've got the other thing I wanted to mention. Well, there are so many things, Michael. You can go on about all these things forever, can't we? But I was thinking about when I was reading your The Food in 21 Santa Cruz book. I was seeing how you've got this transport axis in Santa Cruz, and it just reminded me that we've got exactly the same thing here. There's an old railway that runs through our town that hasn't been used for many years. But the plan is to take up those tracks and convert it into a guided busway. You see. to, and this is going to be the transport access.
I wonder if they're going to build those homes there.
Well, yeah, it's going to link up with those, of course, and this is the plan to. At the present moment, our district is made up of three separate towns. We've got Luton, which is where we live, which is a big one. Then there's Dunstable, which is smaller, and then there's Houghton Regis, which is smaller still. And they've all got their own councils. But the idea is to put this transport axis right the way through the middle of it, link it up with the new development, and it could make it into a huge new authority, if you like.
Blur the boundaries.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. And so I'm sure that's a similar thing to what I read about that's happening in Santa Cruz.
Well, it's happening not just in Santa Cruz. I went to a conference a couple weeks ago, Stewards of the Range, and there was a fella from Eastern Oregon, just this beautiful idyllic valley in the middle of the Cascade Mountains, and there were plans to put them on a train. You know, there's 7,000 people in the county, and they're going to put a train line at a cost of millions of dollars, because even there, they want to change the form of how people operate. If we can't be mobile on our own, in other words, we lose our cars and we're all put on a train in the morning, we will then be assigned where it is we're going to go. Our jobs will be assigned. You know, here in California, Schwarzenegger has his new position. The former head of the Bay Area Council on Sustainable Development is now his secretary for jobs, housing, and transportation, all in one department. You see,
yes.
It's a one-stop shop for that individual who's been displaced with the, with the evolving new world economy, and he shows up and wants a bowl of soup. Well, this government, with the infrastructure they're building now, will give him, a room on the 15th floor. They're now talking about building 14-story buildings here in little idyllic Santa Cruz. So you get a floor way up high, and then you get down on time. You get your train ride out to your assignment in the field. And they'll take your children during the day, beginning at age, right at the beginning. You know, these are the dreams that Stalin had, but never would have imagined. But sustainable development and the accumulation of capital, and then the refocus of that capital into the privately financed, publicly controlled housing facilities that you're seeing in England and that we're now beginning to see here in the United States, is just the ticket that Stalin always imagined. And of course, the way it's being done now, it's going to be far more tyrannical than what Stalin or Mao ever imagined, because these guys are going to have the capital resources that those early communists never had.
That's very interesting you should say that, because I don't know if you've heard of Jonathan Porritt. Have you heard of him?
No, I have not.
Well, he's got an outfit called Forum for the Future, and Jonathan Porritt is a very, very big chum of Prince Charles, and as you know, Prince Charles goes in for the he's a big fan of sustainability and so forth. You know,
our good friend Joan Vion wrote a book called The Sustainable Prince.
That's right. Anyway, Jonathan Porritt, he's got a lot of money backing him up. I went to a meeting. In the City of London Guildhall last June, which was, as you can imagine, it's a splendid venue, and must have cost them quite a bit of money to put the thing on, and it was called Regions to be Cheerful.
Wow. Yeah, the language is always a crack up. I mean,
yeah. And basically what they were saying in there was, we want the regions to be used as the vehicle to get the sustainable development in place. That's what Porritt was saying, and of course it was a usual kind of meeting. It was facilitated, you know, the way they fix it with the Delphi system. So they come out with the answer. They come out with the conclusion that they want, and it was. Very, very slick, actually. A very slick operation. But anyway, Porritt was on he was on BBC Radio 4 the other day, and he said, you've got to realise that we won't be able to put our plans into operation unless we have partnership with private enterprise. You see?
Well, that's the same call that Hitler made when when he looked for his partners, or Mussolini. You know, this is an economic system, that Americans and British citizens need to come to understand is the perfection of what of all that could be wrong. You cannot marry government and business and have human beings operating as human beings.
You cannot. It's fascinating, isn't it? I was going to tell you a bit more about the Fabian Society, Michael.
Okay. Before you do that, let me just let our listeners know that if they've got a question or want a clarification, they can call us and ask our special guest, Robert Theobald. The number is 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, I was just looking at the number of Fabian Society members in the British Parliament. It says in 1922 there were 10 Fabians in the British Parliament. In 1945, that's after the war, half the Labour MPs were Fabians. 229 Fabian members of Parliament, including 10 cabinet ministers.
These people were openly acknowledged?
Yeah. 35 undersecretaries, 10 parliamentary private secretaries. So that was the power of the Fabian Society after the war, you see. That's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Another very interesting man that I've been reading about is a gentleman called Sir Bernard Crick. He's been involved in these Fabian front organisations. One of the early ones was the Study of Parliament group. Bernard Crick, he's an academic and a leading Fabian, and he's still about. He's been going for donkey's years, but he's still about. And the recent thing he's launched is an advisory group on citizenship training in schools for Bernard Crick. We've got a lad of 7 years old, and he goes to school, and we hear about various things that happen that they get up to in schools. But Bernard Crick, he's one of the motors of Fabianism and regionalisation. He's been involved in all that. In 1966, there's a they had the Study of Parliament group, which incidentally didn't have any MPs in it, in actual fact, not directly in it. And they discussed regionalisation in a full and lively fashion, that's their own words. And this is in 1966. And Bernard Crick, he wrote an article in his own magazine. And he's concluded that the Treaty of Rome equated... That's the Treaty of Rome, that's the treaty that sets up the European Union. He concluded that the Treaty of Rome equated to a defined regional policy. So, back in 1966, the Fabians were getting this regionalization lined up.
Well, it's, we've said it often here at Freedom 21, if you can blur the boundaries, starting with the political boundaries, and raid the treasury, you can gather all the riches of all the people. And that's what the globalist movement's all about. That's what public-private partnerships are intended to do. And to make any of that happen, you've got to break down the political boundaries of the two great political entities of the last millennium, England and the United States. And this regionalization program is doing just that. I think you're ahead of us, but we're moving hard and fast. Again, here in California, Schwarzenegger calls for the elimination of counties in his CPR review. That's called, I don't remember what those symbols stand for.
California Performance Review.
That's it, California Performance Review. He calls for elimination of counties, and he calls for the consolidation of all school boards into 10 regions in California. So if you think you got problems with your school districts now, imagine if it's covering 6 counties, a single school board. That would be the average here in the state of California. So regionalization is something alive and well. Al Gore in this country called it the reinvention of government. Ronald Reagan actually in this state is the guy who got it started, saying that political boundaries were horse and buggy era politics, and how wrong he was about that. But it's costing us all now, and it's going to cost us all a whole lot more in the future if this regionalization program isn't blocked.
When I was telling you about the planning, the spatial planning, I was reading about a town in the north of England, Middlesbrough. Now they've decided there that. It's been decided that a particular quarter of the town should be knocked down, and the houses are worth £75,000. They're little houses, but you can only they put a planning order on them now to knock them down, and you can only sell your house to the authorities. And they will give you £35,000 for it. So you're £40,000 missing there. So if you want to go and buy another house in the same area, you've got to pay £75,000. Now they've actually stolen from you more than half the value of your house. Now that's a tyrannical thing that we're starting to see more and more.
Well, our Supreme Court case, Kelo versus City of New London, is an example of that, not in the full extreme that you've just described, but that's where these things are headed. First, they tell you it's not your castle, and then they tell you we're going to tear it down, and then they tell you, well, we might give you a little bit of money, but we'll decide what it is, and we'll have criteria. We have a caller on the line, Roger from Pennsylvania. Roger, are you with us?
Yes, thanks. I wanted to ask, across the pond, is the regionalism more or not much at all sold under the rubric of greater economies of scale? In other words, everybody's groaning under these ever-mushrooming taxes and fees, and so they dangle that out, and you probably don't actually achieve any savings the first year, and right after that they go up, so that's all kind of... fiction. Do you have any examples of that having worked out that way already in other areas, perhaps?
Well, I do. The thing that I mentioned already was the fire brigade, the fire service. They do use that argument for regionalizing the fire service. Yes, they do. And also with the police, they say, oh no, we can't handle the complexity of crime today with the resources that we've got with our local police force. We've got to have it regionalized. It's going to be more economical to do it that way.
Yeah, now here it's more like push for like water and sewage type.
Yeah.
You mean in terms of the regionalization, Roger?
Yeah. That's of course it involves other things, but that's the.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of regionalization in California, certainly, and water is clearly one of them. And regionalizing water has this effect, and it's particularly important here in the arid West. As they begin to regionalize water, it gives them all the excuses that they can begin to dream up for why it is they've got to first meter and then tax and then take. Private wells, and when no human being can tap their own way with their own ingenuity into nature's water supply, well then, by golly, somebody's all got us on a rope.
Thanks for your call, Roger.
Well, Robert, we've got a few minutes left here in the show. Are there some good things happening? Last time you were here, you talked about the Chatham House.
Good thing. Well, we've got a very lively opposition, actually, Michael, to regionalisation. One of the ladies that is very, very active is Jenny Sleep. I keep asking her to come on the American radio, but she's a bit shy. She won't come on. But
keep working on her.
She does so many things. I mean, just on Wednesday they gave out 10,000 leaflets in the streets of Reading, where they were holding the regional assembly meeting. So they just flooded the town with a leaflet that they produced about it. You see.
Fabulous. Does the press then pick up on those kinds of activities?
The press in Reading is very, very sympathetic to us. We had a demonstration outside Chatham House, and I can, as you probably know, that is a centre of Fabianism, and they weren't at all comfortable with us being outside there. I mean, we had permission from the police to be there. But they were very, very uncomfortable with us. We had some big banners. I mean, they were quite accusatory, really. We had but our big banner said Chatham House, where the EU Fabian elite meet to cheat. That was our slogan there. And they were so concerned about us. They sent their photographer. Their Chatham House photographer out onto the balcony to take our photos with his powerful camera. You see.
Before we go, I have one question for your opinion on what is it about China that everybody is so focused on? I mean, California had their governor there, their president has come to see you. We had a big company here, Hewlett-Packard, just opened a big research lab in China. What is it about China?
Well, I think that I think it's different things. I think that lots of business, like I think there's a business angle where they think that where business thinks that it's got to get its slice of the action out of China. I think that many people are afraid of China. And I think they're justified in being afraid of China. And I think that people like Blair, I don't trust his motives at all. But I think there's a fear of China, and there's also a business angle. And we know that it's an extremely dynamic country. We know that the Chinese people are highly intelligent, and there's one or two ideas there, Michael.
Well, thanks so much.
Well, Robert, I want to thank you for getting up early while you get us ready for our night sleep. It's always wonderful to talk to you, and the best to you and the people you work with in England, because America is in your footsteps in many ways, and together. Together we're going to beat this global monster.
And don't forget, a good new book out is by Lindsay Jenkins, Disappearing Britain. Look out for that one. And I think you may get Lindsay on your phone.
Thank you very much.